WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. It is debate night for seven Republicans seeking the presidential nominations. Not taking the stage, frontrunner and former President Trump, ABC News political analyst Rachel Bade.
So there's no sign yet that Donald Trump skipping these debates is hurting him in any way. If anything, it's only making him stronger.
Former president will be counter-programming at a speech to non-union auto plant workers in Michigan. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says the chamber will consider a stopgap funding measure to avoid a government shutdown over the weekend.
We're going to concentrate on trying to do our job here in the Senate, which I think is to pass a bill that keeps the government open.
U.S. Army spokesman says Private Travis King, who ran across the border into North Korea in July, is now headed to Texas. Could face repercussions in the future, but for now, a spokesman says the focus is on King's well-being. This is ABC News. A Massachusetts grand jury indicting a man who allegedly attempted to stab a flight attendant and opened a plane door in mid-flight in March. An American astronaut is back home as a reluctant history maker.
It was supposed to be a six-month mission, but it was more than a year between when astronaut Frank Rubio lifted off and when he landed back on Earth in Kazakhstan on Wednesday morning.
Undocking confirmed. Physical separation confirmed.
That was the sound of the Soyuz spacecraft unlocking from the International Space Station. It had a coolant leak that required a replacement craft being sent up. That's what caused the delay. NASA's Rubio spent 371 days in orbit, studying a lot of things, including how spaceflight affects the human body, both physically and psychologically. Sherry Preston, ABC News.
Remember back in August when there was just one winner of the $1.6 billion Mega Millions jackpot in Neptune Beach, Florida? Well, that winner has come forward to claim the prize. Andy Field, ABC News.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
For the Talk of Green Bay News, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what you need to know.
Amid reports of several missing people in northeast Wisconsin, there is some good news. Yasmin Alon and her two-year-old daughter Amina have been found shortly before noon today. They had been missing since September 21st. There are no further details being released at this time, but we'll keep you posted. A loaded handgun was confiscated from a passenger at Appleton Airport. The TSA says the incident happened about 5:30 a.m. Sunday morning. They detected the gun in a carry-on bag during a routine screening. They alerted the Outagamie County Sheriff's Office, which determined the gun was loaded. Authorities are not offering any information about possible charges at this time. This is the eighth firearm found at the Appleton Airport in 2023 so far.
Tonight's Powerball jackpot is $835 million. Don't get frustrated if you haven't won yet. Every loss brings you closer to victory.
Pete Schwabe, WGBW 97.9 News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Do you support the legalization, regulation, and taxation of legal cannabis in the state of Wisconsin? You said yes! Melissa, that was like 12 years ago! What do you think the hang-up is?
It's the Republicans. They're suffering from reefer madness. They're out-of-touch legislators in the Capitol building who don't want to give a win to Governor Evers and Democrats.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Under the helmet with the gravedigger, Gilbert Brown.
Jordan Love was 15 for 27 for 245 yards and three TDs against a JV team.
Oh, my and, God. I mean, I don't like Chicago, but I ain't going to call them a JV team. They suck, but it's a slap in the face. Okay. I'm laughing at y'all Bear fans.
I know, man.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger with Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday mornings at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Aaron comes in every day looking like he just stepped out of a Turkish bathhouse because it's so hot in there. Just to recap, so far the segment has been filled with dog vomit, old men peeing, and Aaron wearing a dish towel. So we're...
Hey man, your name's on the show. Your name's on the show.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings 6 till 8. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Mino and the Mayor.
What do you think of this team, Brady, with the new quarterback?
It's such a wild card because you go all the way back to Aaron Rodgers. What's been cool about my football experience is I've seen this. Aaron was a good player. Nobody ever expected him to become a first ballot Hall of Famer, especially under the circumstances of having to replace a Hall of Famer, which is rare.
Weekday mornings from 6 until 8 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, and on the Civic Media app.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
What to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Mike Booth, who's the UAW's lead negotiator in the talks with the Big Three, was quoted by the Detroit Free Press. And this is what it said about Donald Trump, you know, coming to Michigan. He said, let me be blunt. Donald Trump is coming off as a pompous ass, coming to Michigan to speak to a non-union employer and pretending it has anything to do with our fight at the Big Three is just more verbal diarrhea from the former president. And I couldn't agree. That's the great line right there. I got to tell you, the UAW leadership and the messaging coming out of them, fantastic. And putting the exclamation points where they belong. You know, you got a billionaire ex-president who doesn't give a tinker's damn about working people, yet there he is pandering after having told the big Lordstown lie. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the strike and talk about our weekend as I visited the Toledo plant, the Jeep plant, and then went up into Michigan to see a couple other strike lines. That's why I've asked former Representative Andy Levin to come talk with us. He's a distinguished fellow, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. Andy, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's so good to be with you, Rick, and thanks for coming to Michigan.
No, it was great to see you and your father on the picket line, 92 years old, still out there, walking the picket line. Amazing, amazing.
I mean, it was so moving to me to get out there with my dad. He loved it. You saw it. He just loved being out there. And he just wanted to talk to every single worker he could to hear their story. What do you think? And of course, he's been, he was involved with the labor movement from the late 50s on. So he's seen all these strikes, and he knows how important this one is for the working class in this country.
What do you think of the comment by Mike Booth about Trump coming to Michigan? And I think he's spot on to pretend that it has anything to do with why those people are out on the picket line is just, more verbal diarrhea. I love that frame.
I heard it when you said it, Mike. I hadn't seen it, Rick. I hadn't seen it before from Mike Booth. One of the things that's refreshing is how straightforward the UAW leadership is. Look at what they've been doing. They're talking, first of all, they're listening to the members, and all their contract proposals are coming directly from what the members say that is most important to them. But, the way Sean Fain does these Facebook Lives, directly telling it like it is to people, I think there's something to be said for throwing a piece of trash contract proposal in the trash that gets the message across, So, they're out there fighting for the basic question of, can a working class job be a middle class, create a middle class life anymore? And if it can't, our country's going to continue to be in deep trouble. But I think they're going to show that it can. And like the UPS workers did with the Teamsters over the summer.
Now, we met up in Centerline, Michigan, at a Mopar distribution plant, a parts distribution center. And, the people there that I met, people 30, 40, 50 years working in that facility and telling the story about how that used to be the gold standard job that people, left other jobs to go and get. And just year after year and, give back and being squeezed and, one thing after another that has, made their standard of living go down. And not just theirs, but everyone around them. And the look in their eye when they say, look, we got a chance to turn that around. I got to tell you, very, very exciting.
It was amazing. That one guy who had been there 54 years.
Yeah.
That was amazing to me. But also we talked to people who've been there, 8 years, 5 years, and people on both sides of the divide. I mean, one of the things that I think is so important to communicate to everybody watching and listening to you is that we these two-tier contracts are so corrosive, and they're unjust, and they divide people, and both people who are getting screwed by it because they're on the lower tier, but just as much the people on the higher, who are grandfathered and they're in the higher tier, they don't like it either. They don't want to be working next to somebody who's doing the same job and not getting fair pay. So I think the level of solidarity among the workers was really remarkable and notable. And they're sticking together. And I think the American people, as far as I can tell, are standing with them so far.
How big of a deal was it?
What do you think?
How big of a deal do you think it was that President Biden was on the picket line yesterday?
It was huge. I mean, I'm not a historian, but, people are saying this is the first time in our history that a sitting president has gone and walked a picket line with workers on strike. And it's equally important what he said. Do they deserve 40% more? Yeah, they do. I mean, remember, we're not talking about a 40% raise today. We're talking about raises over a multi-year contract after inflation has eaten away, the value of what people are making. And they're fighting for a decent wage, COLAs so that they have cost of living adjustments, getting rid of two tiers, and security for these new electric vehicle plants. I mean, I think the UAW leadership and membership is saying, okay, we understand we got to make the switch to electrification. If we can make it all union and have a decent life, we're for it. But if not, we're going to walk this picket line. And I think they're doing just the right thing.
Yeah.
Biden needs to be both for the transition to electrification and for the workers.
And for a just transition, you're right. Now, the picket line that you and I walked on, I understand there was some trouble after we left.
I saw it in the paper. A car drove up, and people got out and started fighting with particularly black strikers and saying inappropriate things to them, literally fighting with them. The guy got out, and then a woman got out and started fighting with people. There were children in the car. It was just, it seemed like from what I read in the newspaper that it was a racially tinged incident. But you know what? Overwhelmingly, what I've seen at that picket and in other work sites and just in general from the public, at least in Michigan, overwhelming support for the union and its demands. Yeah. And I also, Rick, look, we saw workers on that picket line who voted for Trump. And this is significant, I think. They are standing in solidarity, wanting to fight for a good contract. I think they'll appreciate that Biden went there. But the most important thing is there is just a new sense of life and political, activity and solidarity in the membership there. That's really encouraging to me about the future.
No, I'm right there with you. And I had a guest on last night who said, look, you know, the fact that they're doing this, the fact that they're fighting the good fight and hopefully they win a good contract, it's going to help them organize all the other plants that they haven't been able to, because, you know, in the past, and this was his words, not mine, the UAW, you know, looked like they were not behind the workers. They looked like they had some problems. The corruption word came up. But he thinks that now with the new leadership, new militancy, that this is going to help drive organizing. And I'm curious what you think.
Well, look at the plain spokenness of the quote you gave from the bargainer. And look at the way Sean Fain talks. Number one, he talks about his own faith. That's interesting. Number two, he doesn't shy away from talking about we're the working class. We are getting, you know, we've given everything back. We want it back now. It's only fair. And he doesn't shy away from talking about how they're fighting for, you know, the whole working class, not just their members. This is like, sounds like Walter Reuther to me. And I think that it's going to do exactly what you say. It's going to help. People are just going to have a whole new attitude toward organizing in these non-union plants if they can win really strong contracts and just be there fighting the good fight to rebuild the middle class in this country.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with former Michigan Representative Andy Levin. He's a distinguished senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website if you want to take a look at the work that they do there. I got to get your thoughts on this. The shutdown is coming. It looks like your former institution has lost its freaking mind. The crazy caucus has taken over. I'm curious, are you planning to see us with a shutdown happening? Is there a way forward here, do you think? Curious your thoughts.
Well, for sure there's a way forward. I mean, for one thing, other democracies don't do this. Rick, if, you know, the government may fall in Italy every 9 months sometimes, but that's like a new election for the parliament. Social security checks keep going, right? Whatever they have, like women, infants, and children, support for nutrition, keep going. The idea that you shut down the government, the functioning of your government as a, you know, blackmail negotiating tool is just outrageous. And so it should never happen. But here we are, as you say, the crazy caucus. We have a speaker who is so weak and agreed to rules so ridiculous so that any one of his own flock can call for a vote for him to be deposed anytime they want to. And he is at their beck and call. He does whatever the heck they want. So the Senate has shown there's a way forward. They're moving forward with a bipartisan measure to keep the government open, keep it functioning. And but as you say, it does not seem like Kevin McCarthy has the wherewithal and the ability to get something like that passed in the House. So if there's a government shutdown, it will be 100% the fault of the MAGA Republicans. And it's the hostages that are being taken and the people that are being hurt are the American people who depend on these services every day. And it's really shameful that it's come to this. Yeah, but here we are.
To steal a Bush frame, it's uniquely American that we're willing to starve children and not pay our soldiers and all of, not take care of our veterans and all of this stuff because they're having a hissy fit. Uniquely American. But Andy, I appreciate you taking some time for us. I look forward to talking to you again. It was really good seeing you over the weekend as well.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's always good to talk to you. Take care.
You too. Our good friend Andy Levin. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I want to throw out a reminder. You remember after the pandemic, the numbers were going around that workers lost some $3.7 trillion during the pandemic? They lost $3.7 trillion in earnings. And yet our billionaire class, our wealth class, our upper echelon, they somehow got richer by $3.9 trillion. That seems, I don't know, seems kind of convenient. And I, you know, I just had to throw that out. I know this is an old number. I know it's kind of, you know, this was the Trump era. This is what the Trump years brought us. Massive, massive redistribution of wealth. So to have people say to me, well, you know, he was good for the economy. No. Whose economy? His own? Yeah, probably. And I look at the house thing. I look at the, you know, it's big news that his company literally got the death penalty. They literally have to disband the Trump Organization in New York. They have pulled their charter. They've pulled their papers. They're done. And I loved the argument. And I got a couple of, you know, people to, you know, to come back to me and say, you know, well, how come we're not, you know, looking at all of this other stuff? And I'm hoping they are. Because Saudi Arabia came up. His argument for overinflating the price of houses and properties. His argument is he could never overinflate them. They could never be inflated because he could always get what he wanted from someone in Saudi Arabia. And you go, you know, to have that kind of belief that I can get whatever I want, what did you do for it? You know, there's so much around Saudi Arabia and Kushner and the Trump kids and Trump himself. How much technology did we give them? How much nuclear ability did we give them? How come we're not talking about that? We're talking about Hunter Biden's laptop, who was not even in the government, had no control of anything. And yet we've got a former president saying, I can't inflate something. You know, Mar-a-Lago was worth 100 times what the judge said, which was $18 million, which would have been $1.8 billion. It seems like a lot. Even Zillow said only $24 million, and they're known for overinflating. But I got to tell you, David Frum actually hit the nail on the head. And he said, look, if Mar-a-Lago is worth $1 billion, why does it only pay $500,000 in property tax? Uh-oh. And this is one of those things where I read that and I'm going, you know, it's the reason that I don't lie. It's the reason that I don't lie, because once you tell one lie, you've got to tell another. And then you got to remember the first one so that it matches with the second. And then if you tell a third, now you got to remember two more and so on. By the time you end up lying your way down the road, you got to remember 20 things. I can't even remember the truth half the time, let alone 15 lies. So this is one of those moments where you go, you've dug yourself a deeper hole. It's like they say, when you're digging a hole, the best thing you can do is just stop. The best thing Trump could do is just stop. Because this is the right question. Now, the tax bill for Mar-a-Lago was, you know, 511 $1,000. That's a lot of money, but not what you would see on a billion-dollar property. I know, he could get whatever he wanted. He just didn't want that much this month. He didn't want that much. He only wanted $18 million, or whatever he paid the taxes on. And this is the weird thing, because I saw this story today that, and again, you know, understand, there's a lot of really important stuff going on. The president's, historic, walking the picket line. There's all this stuff going on. What we've got to see is the polling on who Republicans see as a person of faith. That's the big story. And I'm like, really? But here's the thing. Evidently, a Harris X poll did ask this question. Who do Republicans see as a person of faith? Was it Donald Trump? Was it Mitt Romney? Was it Mike Pence? A whole bunch of national figures they threw out. 53%, the largest number, 53% said Donald Trump was a person of faith ahead of everyone else on the list. Even Mike Pence. I believe Mike Pence could tell you what's in the Bible. I know Donald Trump can't tell you what's in there. Mitt Romney is a devout Mormon. Probably one of the most religious people in the Senate. And yet Donald Trump, guy who paid a porn star. And I know what the argument is, but Rick, God has chosen him as a vessel. God has chosen him to lead us wherever. It's frightening when you stop and you think about the George Carlin bit. You know, when you think about, how does he put it? When you think about how stupid half the American people are, the average person is, and then remember half of them are dumber than that. That jumps out at me. A guy who, philanderer, liar, cheat, thief. Wow. But the most religious, the person of faith. I think we've got some serious problems. I think we've got some issues, folks. There are some issues. The big one, obviously, we're steaming towards the shutdown. And McCarthy says not going to allow a vote on the Senate stopgap because, hey, why would we want to stop chaos? Because I truly believe they want chaos. They want economic destruction. They want pain and suffering. They want chaos. And I think I think even if it hurts them, they still want it. Because they know that the average American, they're not going to remember in 6 months. So as we have this moment right now where FEMA, our emergency management agency, they are now, what are we, 4 days from the shutdown? They are now beginning to ration some of the disaster aid. Evidently, they're delaying the delivery of about $2.8 billion in grants so that they have money in the event of a crisis. So this is one of those moments where you go, hope it doesn't rain. Hope we don't have a hurricane. Hope we don't have a fire. Hope we don't have a tornado. Hope we don't have a disaster. Let's not. Because we have a government that's incapable of responding. Because we've got children and crazy people in charge of it. And it's our fault. We elected these people. Well, not all of us. Clearly I did not vote for Scott. Pardon me. I don't want you to know what's on my cell phone, Perry. Clearly I didn't vote for him. But a number of my neighbors did. And too many of them. This is why we need more people to register to vote. Make sure you're registered. Make sure you make a plan to vote. Make sure your registration is there. And then vote. and vote for people who and this is the part that's always gotten me, because you got the Scott Perrys of the world who say, you know, government shouldn't, can't, we shouldn't allow them to do anything. And then they set out to prove that the Republican government is broken and will always be broken. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back and talk about Las Vegas, looks like some big happenings, huge potential strike, some 53,000 hospitality workers potentially going on strike. I'm gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1903. That was the day that is remembered in Virginia as the wreck of Old 97. Old 97, also known as the Fast Mail, was a Southern Railway freight train. It carried the U.S. mail from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta, Georgia. The train wreck happened on the leg of the trip from Monroe, Virginia to Spencer, North Carolina. The train had come in late to Monroe. It was reported that the railway company ordered the engineer to increase the speed of the train to make up time. The company had to pay a penalty if they delivered the mail late. But when the train neared Danville, Virginia, the tracks curved at the Stillhouse Trestle Bridge. The speed was simply too much. Despite the engineer's efforts to slow the train, it careened off the tracks and plummeted to the rocky ravine 45 feet below. 11 of the 16 people on board the train died, including the conductor, the engineer, and the flagmen and both firemen. The railway company blamed the wreck on the deceased engineer. Newspapers across the country carried photos of the wreck. The disaster became the subject of multiple ballads. One version, by Vernon Dalhart in 1924, is thought to be the first million-selling country record in U.S. history. Johnny Cash recorded another well-known version of the song. In 1993, an alternative country band took the name the Old 97s, hearkening back to the disaster and the songs it inspired.
They gave him his orders at Monroe, Virginia. Said, Steve, you're way behind time. This is not 38, this is Old 97. You must put her into Spencer on time.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Oklahoma troubadour Woody Guthrie wrote a song about outlaws that was right on target. As through this world I've traveled, I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. That could apply today to Clayton Bennett, a multimillionaire Oklahoma City banker who has regularly wielded his fountain pen to loot public funds for his private gain. Bennett is a Hall of Infamy player in the elite club of big league owners of pro basketball teams, specializing in picking taxpayers' pockets to finance his operations. In 2006, he and a few high-rolling partners bought the Seattle Supersonics team, promptly demanding that locals pony up $500 million to build a new arena for them. No, said Seattle. So Bennett and gang scampered off to Oklahoma City with the team, renaming it the Thunder. Then they used their fountain pens to filch a $215 million subsidy from local officials. Gratitude? Robbers don't say thank you. They refill their fountain pens. As Judd Legum reports in his excellent Substack report, Popular Information, Bennett is now demanding $850 million from Oklahoma City taxpayers to build a glittery new basketball palace for him. Legum notes that this is about $3,200 for every Oklahoma City household, and that Bennett's take will deplete the budgets of about a dozen essential community projects. He also has an inside accomplice, the mayor. Having taken Bennett cash to get elected, Mayor David Holt is now warning taxpayers to hand over millions to his rich banker buddy, or the Thunder will leave town. This is Jim Hightower saying, so go! The thieving won't stop until the people stop the thieves. Boom, 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 ship the whole herd of thundering thieves out of town, including Bennett and that pusillanimous mayor.
The-
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember we had Ted Papa George on from the Culinary Workers Union the other night, talking about the strike authorization vote that they were going to pursue. They were going to rent out the, I think it was the big arena that UNLV plays at. And you saw this huge arena just packed with people. 95% voted to authorize a strike, a citywide strike, with the bartenders and the culinary union. And this could be 53,000 people on strike. Here to share some thoughts on, well, this and, well, all the strike. It's strike season, isn't it? I've asked Sean Richmond to come talk with us. Sean is a contributing writer at In These Times. He teaches labor history at SUNY Empire and is the author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. Sean, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think of this overwhelming vote of support for a strike by the culinary workers and the bartenders and the hospitality folks there in Las Vegas?
Not unexpected at all. It's an extremely well-organized union, an excellent organizing program, a great leadership structure, shop steward delegates on the shop floor level, a good member organizing program. You know, the members get it. They know this is what it takes to win. The strike vote is the easy thing. This is one of these unions that, you don't see big citywide strikes in Las Vegas in the hotels and casinos. I don't think there's been a citywide strike since the 1980s. And that's because they're so well organized, because they are so ready to go on strike, and the bosses know it, that they tend to win what they need. And it's only, I think it's only in this strike season that we have that you're starting to see the media pay more attention to these strikes and to these strike dynamics, right? And these sort of multi-employer bargaining units, these citywide bargaining units, are very different animals than what people are more familiar with, sort of a one employer, one contract sort of strike. There's all kinds of stuff that goes into the calculus of, are we going to target specific sites? I mean, the UAW strike is, of course, fascinating, right? And they had a lot of fun, walking out at only a couple of facilities and leaving the bosses really surprised about the ones where they didn't walk out, moving supplies to different factories, trying to keep production moving and getting surprised that, we thought they were going to strike here. They didn't. We moved the stuff over here where they did. That's a lot of that's a lot of sort of the strategic and the tactical thinking that goes into these. Yeah.
Now, you said, it's strike season, and we have seen, obviously big strikes and the threat of a big strike with the Teamsters and UPS. And, I saw a poll not too long ago that said, it's like 71% of people support labor unions. But amazingly, 75% of the people polled support strikes and direct action. And I got to tell you, I was a little surprised by it. But when you stop and you think about it, maybe not. Because that kind of direct militancy, that standing up and saying, we deserve and demand better. I think people want that.
People absolutely do want that. You have to take stock of what the bosses did to us in the 1980s. Patco is symbolic. Phelps Dodge, which followed it a few years later, that's where this copper mining company bargained its union out on impasse over draconian cuts in health insurance, in job security and wages, bust in a bunch of strikers and held out for a year, and then had those scabs decertify the bargaining unit, and that became the blueprint. Yep. for de-unionizing well-established bargaining units. They turned strikes from something that was where our power was to something that's where you lose. And strikes became an incredibly terrifying thing for a lot of unionized workers. And for a lot of non-union workers, it was incredibly dispiriting. It's how do you win? You know, if you're watching the United Auto Workers take two-tiered contracts, take all these givebacks, just trying to hold on to their jobs, it didn't give a lot of confidence to, well, you know, if I organize and I can win, already we know the long odds against even winning a union certification election. But where's the pathway to actually winning pensions for the first time when you see unions going on strike and losing their pensions? And so this is so very, very recent, right? And those of us who cover this stuff, who study this stuff, who talk about this stuff, you know, it was in 2019 where we were like, wow, it's the high watermark of strikes in the 21st century. It's like, yeah, we got back to 1986 levels of striking, and 1986 was a really lousy year for going on strike. But it is building up not only a class consciousness, but sort of an action-oriented consciousness among workers, and it's exciting to imagine where it could go.
Yeah, no, we spent the weekend in Toledo at the Jeep plant, and then went up to Michigan, up to Detroit, to a parts plant, and also to the Ford plant there. And you know, the people we were talking to, that kind of ready to fight, that kind of we've had enough direct action, militancy, that kind of stuff, reminded me of stories that I had heard old timers tell me about how it was in the 50s and 60s. And I used to know a guy, and you know, he was much, much older than me. When I was just a kid, he was saying, look, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, we went on strike every other contract, whether we needed to or not, just to get people to have that direct action, to know that they fought for something and that they won for something, and to pull people back together so that you understand that you're a community, you're part of this, that solidarity thing that we talk about. That's what he was talking about. And you know, the more I look back on that, the more he was absolutely right.
Yeah, and you know, well-established and strong unions like Culinary or like its sister union, the Hotel Trades Council in New York, which I, you know, study and work for, you know, their equivalent of it is the preparation for the strike. You know, they have these extremely long contracts. You know, this is, I think, a six-year deal that's expiring in Las Vegas. And the contract that will replace it will likely be 6 or 7 years itself, because the union prepares for war and, in fact, goes to war in the lead up to the strike. I'm sure that there's all kinds of job actions taking place within the terms of the contract, slowdowns, room attendants dropping rooms, health and safety complaints, you know, leading to refusal to do certain duties or to touch certain chemicals. So the members really get prepared. They go through they exercise. It's almost like, you know, it's a muscle and you got to exercise it. So, you know, walk and work demonstrations, right? Picketing after hours, clocking in, doing the work, and then picketing. There's a ton of that. So they're ready to go on strike. And so that the irony is they frequently don't have to, right? And I think one of the things that a lot of us struggle with is you need an example of workers going on strike and winning to inspire non-union workers to feel like they can do it themselves. But when the union is so well organized that the boss knows that they can strike and they can cost a tremendous amount of business and cost market share and do damage that could take years to recover, as with the UPS, you see bosses suddenly getting very reasonable about the bargaining and actually giving in on many of those demands. When you're ready to strike, when you're prepared to strike, when your members have experience getting ready to strike, it's very hard to go on strike sometimes.
No, that's, you know, I say it's the last arrow in the quiver, but when the employer thinks they're going to get the last arrow in their backside, they become very reasonable, as you've said. So, you know, in looking at, you know, this UAW strike, and you know, this is historic in multiple ways. You now have the first president to ever walk a picket line, you know, which for me, I'm hoping is symbolic in a positive way, as where Reagan firing the Patco workers was symbolic in a negative way. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll see about the longer term symbolism. I mean, I think it's hilarious that every story that I've seen written about it has generally said something, some version of, you know, the first time in living memory, or you know, and it's like, no, it's actually the first time. Like, it's just that's actually that's how low the bar is for presidential support of unions. You go back before FDR and they were calling out the National Guard on strikers. And from FDR on, you know, the Republicans always hated us, and the Democrats also kind of hated us. They appreciated unions in their role within the get out the vote and within sort of the governing coalition of getting them elected. But when it came to battles between labor and capital, they really didn't want to take part in that. And to the extent that you had presidents weighing in on collective bargaining disputes in the private sector, you generally had them criticizing the unions. I'm neck deep in researching New York unions in the 1960s, and there was a stretch of time in 1961 where President Kennedy had nothing good to say about New York unions. He was pissed off about the newspaper guilds going on strike. There was a long strike there were no newspapers for a couple of months there. Very critical of the union schools. There was a major electrician strike where the electricians were on strike for I think their goal was like a 30-hour work week. And Kennedy was like, this is inflationary. I'm against this. This goes against the steelworkers pattern, which I endorsed. Again, sitting president is going out of his way to say, I'm against what these unions are going for, right? And we still trot out, you know, these memes about, you know, from, you know, on President's Day, you get each of the presidents and a picture and a quote of what they said. You know what Kennedy's quote is? If you think about it, it is the most negative. He's negging. It's like unions are not narrow self-interested organizations. They've actually done a few good things for us. That's the best you can get out of the guy. He was a senator, he and his brother were investigating the unions and making a big deal over labor racketeering. They passed yet another anti-union bill. I mean, they were not pro-union, right? And this is, you think, this liberal lion, JFK. He was an anti-union jerk. Massachusetts. They're not pro-union in Massachusetts, let me tell you. What does it mean long term? I don't know. It means a tremendous amount for the workers who are out.
So on that front, since you brought the presidents up, you know, Barack Obama tweeted out today, POTUS knows the importance of unions. That's why he joined the UAW picket line yesterday. Right now, unions across the country continue to stand up and advocate for the rights of working Americans, and they deserve our support. This week's Writers Guild of America deal is an example of what's possible. Keep going. Any thoughts, any response on that? Because I'll tell you what Jimmy Williams Jr. Put out. He's the president of IUPAT. He wrote, and I absolutely agree with him. He said, sorry, but you should have sat this tweet out like you sat out Wisconsin and every picket line in 8 years. I gotta be honest, that's the right response right there. Sorry, you should have sat that tweet out. Because you sat out in Wisconsin. Because look, I was sleeping on the floor in Wisconsin. I've walked picket lines during those 8 years that Obama was there. I never saw him with his comfortable shoes. I must have missed him. What do you think, Sean?
He shouldn't have promised that. If he never meant to do it, he never should have promised it, right? Because that quote really sticks in everybody's craw. And that quote is... it's going to be in his obituary, I think. It's going to be one of the legacy of the Obama administration. You know, the banks got bailed out and the rest of us, you know, what did we get?
That's all. No, I tell the story all the time. You know, I shook the man's hand twice. And both times he told me that we were going to get something better than the Employee Free Choice Act, and we got zip. And I tell that story all the time because I'm never, you know, until the day I die, I'm never going to forget that. Because I got to tell you, softest hands of any man I've ever met.
Well, and I mean, and it took him to his second term, I think, to really recognize how existential the decline of unions is to Democrats winning elections. You know, I mean, his second term, the NLRB got really good. It sucks that it took till his second term, because it took a long time for appointments to get made. It was really just in like 2019, 2020. No, 2015, 2016. You know, time flies when you're having a great time with the Trump administration. But it was only those last 2 years that suddenly these amazing decisions that were telegraphing what we could do at the NLRB. I mean, including there was one that I'm waiting for a Bruzzo to pick back up. But there was one that sort of was going back after that McKay permanent replacement doctrine. Which is, you know, then we get this lousy Supreme Court decision in the 1930s that basically said that employers can permanently replace workers who go on strike, even though the plain text of the law as passed said you can go on strike and the government can make, they can't interfere in any way. The bosses can't interfere, that you have a right to go on strike and to return to the job. And, you know, you got these patrician judges who say, well, unless it's necessary for the boss to protect and continue his business, in which case then theoretically they should be able to. Little language that gets thrown in this 38 case, and you know, the right wing doing what it does, the National Right to Work Coalition, all of them build on it in case after case. So eventually they create this legal principle that has no basis in fact, has no basis in the actual decision. And what Obama's NLRB very late in the game revisited is, well, you know, is it necessary to protect and continue his business? Are we going to dig in on that? And, you know, is there not some underlying anti-union animus there? And in the specific case that they found, they actually got a boss that was dumb enough to say that we're permanently replacing these strikers to punish them for going on strikes. Like, yeah, you're not allowed to do that. And if you say it, well, you get caught. I mean, the sick joke of this is that Phelps Dodge, when they bargained their workers out to impasse over, you know, cutting the pension and the health insurance and everything else, there was clearly anti-union animus, right? But you got basically the NLRB was sort of doing its best impression of a referee at a Hulk Hogan match in the 1980s, you know. I didn't see it. You know, we're clearly flagrant violations of the rules. I mean, the goal was clearly union busting, but, well, if it's not technically an unfair labor practice, then we're not going to protect the rights of the strikers. What we need to see is the NLRB fully reverse the McKay decision by enforcing the literal standard of the McKay decision. Is it necessary to protect and continue your business to permanently replace your strikers? Open up your books. Show us how you go out of business, you know, Verizon, multi-billion dollar, you know, telecom company, the Hollywood studios, right? Whoever. Prove to us that you would go out of business unless you could offer your scabs permanent jobs at the expense of the strikers. And also prove to us that anti-union animus is not the real reason that you're hiring the scabs. There's not a boss that could prove that.
Right. No, I got to tell you, I'm thrilled with what Biden's NLRB is doing. But all of this stuff is just one election away from going away, sadly. Because that's how
the extension is for all of us.
This is what I keep telling my union brothers and sisters. You know, Joe Biden may be wearing tennis shoes, which I don't even know why is a story. But he's killing it with the NLRB and the people that he's appointing to help protect and help working people. So I'm thrilled of where things are. But Sean, as always, I appreciate you taking a little time for us. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks so much, Sean Richman. Make sure you grab his book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. We'll be right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the day the International Lady Garment Workers Union began a strike against the Triangle Shirtwaist Company. Eventually, female workers struck at 339 of the 352 shirtwaist manufacturing firms in New York City. The strike was referred to as the Uprising of 20,000. Women comprised 70% of all garment workers. Men performed the higher paid work of cutting and pressing, while women earned less for assembling and finishing garments. Women often had to furnish their own supplies, including needles, thread, and even sewing machines. Some firms locked the doors to each floor. The workers, mostly young girls and women, had to ask permission to go to the bathroom. While the strike initially started at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, it soon spread to other factories. At a meeting of garment workers in November, a young girl, Clara Lemlich, called for a general strike. One day later, 15,000 shirtwaist workers walked out of the factories, with more joining the strike the following day. The strike continued until February 1910 and ended with factory owners agreeing to meet the demands of the workers, which included better pay and shorter hours. This strike was a notable achievement for these mostly immigrant working women. Nevertheless, garment workers after the 1909 strike continued to suffer harsh working conditions. A year later, many workers died in the tragic Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. The fact that the company locked the doors on each floor meant that the workers had no means of escaping the blaze. Today, it's very difficult to find clothing that is union-made. We must work together to restore labor unions to protect the safety of those who make our clothing, both in the United States and throughout the world. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Finish up with, I'm going to do it again. I have now said the words Taylor and Swift back to back more than I have ever done in my entire life. But look, crazy people are making me defend Taylor Swift. And look, it's not that I don't like her. I'm not a country music fan. I think she's, you know, a wonderful, wonderful woman, you know, bright, smart, all that stuff. But not according to the right-wing moron crowd. Evidently, she's stupid, homely, and nasty. Nasty, lots of nasty. What is it about the right when there is a woman who stands up and does something? It's automatically stupid, homely, or ugly, and nasty. Well, it's always nasty. And this Nick Adams, who's someone who, you know, I really can't go into, no, not on terrestrial radio. I'll get myself in trouble. But he bills himself as an alpha male. And you know he was a lunch money victim when he was a kid. I mean, come on. Evidently, he tweeted out that Taylor Swift is a gold digger. Travis, get a prenup. I don't know. I didn't know they were getting married. But here's the weird thing. Travis Kelce probably has a lot of money, but she could probably burn his money because she's got so much. This is another one of those moments where you go, in that crazy right-wing world, who knows what goes on between their pea brains? Because, you know, reality doesn't seem to play into their thing. You know, this guy's going on about how he's, you know, God's gift to women and all this stuff. And I got to tell you, I don't think Taylor Swift would give him the time of day. Look, I give her credit. You know, she went to a football game to support her boyfriend. She registered voters. Oh, that's what it was. That's what ticked everybody off. It was the registering voters, especially young voters, because they might vote for Biden. Now, weirdly enough, a Democrat, Joe Manchin, was asked on State of the Race, which, again, I don't know why we have a TV show called State of the Race, because all we're now doing is creating the, we've got to do this both sidesism stuff. But hey, thanks CNN. But Manchin was asked by the host if he's going to vote for Joe Biden. And Manchin's response was, well, you know, was what you would expect from Joe Manchin. He said, I never thought about that because I've not gotten to that point yet. I'm not saying yes or no on this. Really? really, Joe? Oh. And finally, Omar Navarro has run four times against Maxine Waters. He was charged with 43 criminal counts of funneling tens of thousands of dollars in campaign cash into his own pockets. Yeah, another Republican. Good, upstanding citizen.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.